Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Sarah Charlene Benhamou from Aspen High School, and Lily McCachran and Stephanie Kehoe from Glenwood Springs High School. They are gophers here during this summer, but actually Stephanie is filming our public lectures and had the opportunity to listen to the lecture of Alex Filipenko, and he is being interviewed today, so she has a little inside information. Alex Filipenko is an elected member of both the National Academy of Sciences and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and is one of the world's most highly cited astronomers. He is the winner of the prestigious Teaching Award at UC Berkeley, voted the best professor on campus a record of 9 times, and named the U.S. National Professor of the Year in 2006. He has produced 5 astronomy video courses with the Great Courses, which actually we have here at the Aspen Center for Physics if you'd like to borrow them. A co-authored and award-winning astronomy textbook, and appears in over 100 TV documentaries. He has given more than 1,000 public presentations and received the 2004 Carl Sagan Prize for Science Popularization. A special note today, he is addicted to observing total solar eclipses throughout the globe, 15 so far, all successfully. He is also an active researcher in the areas of exploding stars, that's supernovae, active galaxies, black holes, neutron stars, gamma ray bursts, and cosmology. Hello to all of you, and welcome to Radio Physics.
Well, thank you very much, Patty, for that very interesting and flattering introduction. It's such a pleasure to be here at the Aspen Center for Physics. I love coming here. Talking physics with my colleagues here is wonderful in these truly magnificent surroundings. So thank you very much for your hospitality.
I'm Sarah. I'm just wondering how you got into physics and what got you interested in astrophysics.
Well, I've been interested in science since my earliest days. You know, when I was in first grade, I would play with magnets and feel this force, but I couldn't see it, and it was clearly different from whatever it is that holds me to Earth, gravity. And I would drag magnets in a sandbox and pick up little black specks, which turned out to be iron filings. And I decided to someday understand this phenomenon. And then I got interested in other things, you know, bugs and electronic circuits and microscopes and things. Chemistry was my main addiction from age 10 through 17. So right around when I was your age, I was actually planning to become a chemist. But when I was a freshman in high school, I received a small telescope as a gift from my parents. And I took it out that night, Christmas Eve, and the first star I looked at, you know, looked brighter. That's what stars do through a telescope. They look brighter, but they don't look any bigger because stars are so far away that they still look like points of light. So then I pointed to a second star and it looked brighter, and the novelty was beginning to wear off. But I thought, well, before I put the telescope away and go to the library next week, you know, and find out where the good stuff is, you know, the internet didn't exist back then, I would point to one final third bright star and then pack up the telescope. Well, that star looked a little bit bigger, fuzzier than the other two stars I had looked at. And so when I let the telescope's vibrations die down, I realized that I was looking at the planet Saturn. So that just knocked my socks off. You know, that night I discovered Saturn on my own. No one had told me to look at that star. Didn't matter that millions of people had seen it before me. That night I discovered it. And so I realized that if the thrill of discovering something that everyone else already knows about is so great, what must be the thrill of learning something truly new to humankind in nature? And so astronomy started becoming a growing hobby, and its slope of my interest was greater than that of chemistry. So somewhere in the middle of my freshman year in college, I actually decided to switch to physics with the intention of becoming an astrophysicist. And I'm still interested in chemistry, but I've never regretted my move. I'm more interested in physics, and in particular, the physics of the cosmos. So that's sort of my story.
What led you to decide to teach and teach astrophysics?
Well, you know, when I decided in college to become an astrophysicist and I switched from chemistry to physics for my undergraduate degree, it became pretty clear that to really get to the cutting edge of research, one needs to go on and get a PhD. And so I did that. And then there are sort of two options as an astrophysicist. You can either be at a university, or you can be at an observatory, or in a few cases, a pure research place like the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. That's not an observatory where you're helping out, but it's also not a university where you're teaching classes. Most options have to do with universities, being a professor in a university. So that was a clear career path for me. Moreover, I started giving public talks even near the end of my graduate studies, and certainly when I became a postdoc at Berkeley, and I found that I really enjoyed interacting with the public. In fact, it goes farther back than that. In my senior year and also in my junior year as an undergraduate, during the summers, I had the opportunity to work at Lick Observatory, which is owned and operated by the University of California. And I basically gave tours there and also sold postcards in the gift shop. But I found as a junior and senior that giving these tours was a lot of fun, and interacting with the public and answering their questions was a lot of fun. And in fact, now that you ask this question, it goes even farther back than that, because during the academic year, during my undergraduate time at UC Santa Barbara, my advisor somehow managed to give me the opportunity to teach an undergraduate course to just a small group of students. And so this actually, I think, even preceded my summer jobs at Lick Observatory. But I realized then that I like to teach in a formal setting, not just an informal setting, you know, giving tours and stuff and giving public talks. So becoming a professor at a university and teaching classes and doing research together became a natural career path. And then finally, I found that when interacting with students and teaching, they would ask questions that would force me to understand more thoroughly what it was that I was teaching and what it was that I'm researching. Because as a few of my professors said during my career, if you can't explain something in a simple way, it probably means you don't yourself understand it sufficiently deeply. And so in a sense, interacting with students and being inspired by them, by their questions, by their curiosity, was a positive effect on my research as well. So in my opinion, teaching and research go hand in hand, and I probably wouldn't want to be at an institution where the only thing I'm supposed to be doing is sitting around and doing research. I find the back and forth with students and postdocs and the general public even to be fruitful for my own enjoyment of the field and for my research.
Like Patty said in the intro, you've seen 15 total solar eclipses, and like I heard on the talk, those aren't easy to catch, that you have to be in the right place at the right time. So I'm just kind of wondering what fascinates you so much about those.
Oh, gosh. You know, to those who have not witnessed a total solar eclipse, people who have sound a little bit nutty, a little bit loony. And in fact, I use the pun lunatic because it's the moon, lunatic, right? It's indescribable. You know, the photographs don't give any sort of justice to the whole phenomenon, because in a photograph, you just see one still image. You don't see the range of brightnesses in the corona and the chromosphere. You don't witness the reaction of people around you. You don't feel the changing temperatures. You don't see the rapidly changing light that's surrounding you, or the darkness that's coming in when the shadow comes over you. So the photos just are completely crummy. Videos do a better job, but they too don't capture the changing temperatures and everything else. It's just this incredibly moving experience that's extremely difficult to describe. But most people I've met who finally witness a total solar eclipse on their own not just through pictures and videos, is what I'm trying to say. If they personally witness a total solar eclipse, they then get it. Very few people don't get it. Most people become quite enthralled by the phenomenon and say, gosh, I've got to see another one someday. So it's just something you've got to do. And, you know, we've got this fantastic opportunity coming up on August 21st, 2017, where for the first time in 38 years, the path of totality crosses the continental U.S., at least parts of it. And for the first time in 99 years, let's just call it a century, it goes from the West Coast to the East Coast. So tens of millions of people literally have the opportunity to see this eclipse coming up. 12.5 million people live within the path of totality, and 27 or 30 million, something like that, live within 100 or 200 miles of totality. So it'll be easy for them to get to. And here in Aspen, you're only 200 miles from the path of totality. So I encouraged everyone who isn't fixed by their jobs or other obligations to be in Aspen on August 21st. I actually encouraged them to travel north up to Casper, Wyoming, or to other areas that are really pretty nearby. I mean, Wyoming's just the next state north of Colorado, right? So it's an easy drive. So go see it if you have a chance. And I don't know if schools will have started by then, but if not, then you have no excuse. And, you know, go up there and see it. Yeah, you too will become a convert. In the eclipse path, some schools have delayed officially their starting time because of the eclipse. Yeah.
I'm just wondering how, because I'm seeing how exciting you're getting talking about people who are first witnessing solar eclipses. So I'm wondering how important it is to you to like introduce people to the world of astrophysicists and physics in general.
Yeah, so I love talking about astrophysics. That's one reason I've given hundreds, if not, you know, 1,000 public talks or so in various settings. Now, some of those were to private groups, little groups at their houses or whatever, but they were still public talks in the sense that they were not part of my university teaching duties. So obviously, you know, to have done that in 3 or 4 decades, that's, if you figure it out, a lot of talks per year. So I clearly enjoy this. And in part, I think it's because everyone, every human has some natural curiosity about the world around them and about physics and nature. And what physicists are trying to do is understand at a deeper level nature and our very origins. And so one area of my research is to study these supernovae, exploding stars. And it turns out that, you know, the universe was born with only hydrogen and helium in the Big Bang and a smidgen of the next element, lithium. All the other elements were cooked up through nuclear reactions deep in the cores of stars. And only because some of those stars explode do those elements then become available as raw material for the formation of new stars, planets, and ultimately life. So as Carl Sagan used to say, you know, we are made of star stuff, the carbon in your cells, the oxygen that you breathe and that's in water, the calcium in your bones, the iron in your red blood cells, the phosphorus in your DNA, things like that. All those elements were cooked up by stars and ejected by these colossal explosions. So we are made of star stuff. Now, I find that when people first learn that concept, almost invariably, they're really turned on by it. I mean, you have to be a little bit either distracted by your cell phone or text messaging or Snapchat or not very curious about the world to not be intrinsically turned on by the concept that the elements in our bodies quite literally came from stars billions of years ago. So I love exposing people to those kinds of concepts. It's fun. It's fun to see the delight in their faces, and also, especially for the harder things to understand, that spark that they feel when they understand what it is you're saying. Not just hear the words, but understand a difficult concept. That's actually one of the joys of teaching, is to convey true understanding to one's students. It's a good feeling.
So do you think that one of the things that led you to teaching, especially at a university, was to expose students to just the passion of getting to know like what's behind our stars and our universe and what's inside of us?
Oh, definitely. You know, I like to teach the introductory course, not just the advanced courses for astrophysicists, but the introductory course, in part because I get to bring science to students who are largely not already interested in science. In fact, this introductory course satisfies their physical science requirement. They have to take something, so why not astronomy? And they've heard that, you know, I'm pretty good at this and stuff. And so my course is really quite popular, 800, 850 students. And it's not just that people are naturally curious, but sometimes need this curiosity sort of fanned or fueled or ignited. You know, it's in there somewhere, but they need something to ignite that spark. It's also that, you know, we scientists are very fortunate because taxpayer dollars fund a good fraction of what it is we do. And so the general public has a right to know what it is that we're doing with their dollars. Now, we'd love there to be more federal support for pure and applied research, but we're grateful for what we get. I mean, there are many, many things vying for the discretionary spending of the federal budget. And so we owe it to the community, to the public, to discuss what it is we do. And so the public lecture series that the Aspen Center for Physics puts on is a way to give back to people and to get them interested and cognizant of what it is we do. And so then they might support science when, in fact, various bills come up and Congress thinks about how much money to devote to research. Maybe the public will write letters and say, hey, this is actually important to support, and we like science and what scientists are doing, and it's good for the world.
Would you give like a brief introduction onto what exactly like supernovae are and what you do as an astrophysicist?
Right. So supernovae are exploding stars. Most stars die relatively quietly at the end of their lives. Our own sun will, in about 5 billion years, turn into what's called a red giant. It'll become much more powerful than it is now, but it'll do that kind of gradually, and it'll get bigger, and Earth will get fried. So, you know, we better get out of here before that happens, okay? So that's what most stars do. And then they gently eject those outer envelopes of the red giant. And then what's left behind is a compact type of star called a white dwarf. It's actually a very interesting star. But anyway, that's how most stars end. But certain types of very massive stars and a subset of lower mass stars that combine with another star can blow up. They go through a set of nuclear reactions that completely explodes them. Or in the case of the massive stars, the core, an iron core, gets built up near the end of the life of the massive star, and then it can't hold itself up because its weight is so great. The gravity pulling it in is so great. So it actually collapses to form the neutron stars that my colleagues and I are studying these 3 weeks. But the neutron star forms, the outer envelope blows outward. A bunch of heavy elements that had been generated by nuclear reactions in the star prior to the supernova get ejected, and additional elements get ejected because they get produced during this explosion itself. So all these elements get ejected outward. They then sort of fly away and form what's called a supernova remnant. And we see remnants. For example, there's a famous one called the Crab Nebula, which is the remnant of a supernova that Asian astronomers, I don't think they were called that back then, but Asian observers of nature noticed in the year 1054. And we now see this expanding debris, which is chemically enriched. We can tell by analyzing the light that it's chemically enriched in all these heavy elements. And they go floating away for tens of thousands of years and then gradually merge with other clouds of chemically enriched gases and finally form a nebula like the Orion Nebula in the sword of the constellation Orion, the Great Hunter, which is gravitationally unstable. And it then collapses down and starts forming new stars and planets circling them. And after many generations of this stellar birth and death, you get enough chemical enrichment such that some of the planets that form in the debris disks around a newly formed stars can be rocky Earth-like planets, not just big gaseous giants like Jupiter and Saturn. And on those rocky Earth-like planets, in principle, especially if water is present and maybe some other substances, life might form. And clearly we were the result of this formation process, which we now see going on elsewhere. We have not yet found life elsewhere, but we see the chemical signatures that go into life, and we see rocky Earth-like planets elsewhere, some of which are in the habitable zone. So water might exist there, and life might have developed there, and that's one of the things that astrophysicists are looking for, and astrobiologists are obviously very interested in the possibility of life elsewhere. Now, I forgot your original question, but did I answer it?
So has there ever been like a setback in your research or something that has made you question your choice of astrophysics, or has it always been just a straightforward path?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question, too. And it reminds me that I guess I didn't quite finish what I wanted to reply to the previous question. Yes, my research in part is studying this process. How does a supernova form? How does a neutron star form? What are the elements that are ejected and so on? We also use supernovae to study cosmology, the universe on large scales. Maybe we'll get to that later. So yes, there have been setbacks. You know, in science, it's never a clear path without obstacles. And in fact, part of what defines who makes it in science is who has the grit to keep going, even though you're not making progress some of the time and you're either out of ideas or your data are not as good as you thought they are, or something went wrong with the telescope or something. And so there have been many such setbacks, and you just keep going, you know. And I've always been grateful that I kept going, because I got out of these slumps, and then something really great comes along, and, you know, and you discover something new, or you have some new insight, or you understand something better. So you just keep on going, you know. It's not a smooth path.
How is your study of astrophysics and kind of like life in space, how is that applicable to Earth? And, you know, is there a connection there?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, you know, the understanding of the origin of the elements certainly helps us understand our own origins. You know, we still don't understand how life arises. That's for biologists. They have a much tougher job than astrophysicists do. But at least as astrophysicists, we've figured out where the elements of which we consist ultimately came from. They came from stars. So we understand ourselves better through these kinds of studies. But your question actually is a deeper one. People often ask, you know, why pursue this kind of pure research? And I have three reasons. First, of all animals that we know of, humans are the only ones that have the curiosity and the intellect to ask and answer questions, and the opposable thumb with which to build machines that help answer those questions. So that's something that sets Homo sapiens aside from all other animals. You know, whales and dolphins are pretty smart, but there's no evidence at all that they ask abstract questions, and they certainly can't build machines. So a small subset, at least, of humanity should do this simply because it can. It's sort of like the mountain that can be climbed. Secondly, these kinds of studies excite kids, all right? And people your age, older, you know, young adults, and they become more likely to pursue areas of science and technology. Most won't become astrophysicists, but they'll move into areas that are more immediately useful to society, like engineering, applied physics, medical physics, computer science. But astronomy is the bug that bites them, in a sense. It's the gateway science, I like to say. And then finally, you never know what practical spin-offs there might be far in the future. And the two examples I like to give are the quantum physicists of a century ago, Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, Schrödinger, had not the slightest practical application in mind when they were developing quantum physics. They wanted to understand the nature of atoms and the nature of light. Those were two big questions, and there were other ones as well. Well, fast forward a century, you couldn't imagine modern technology with our understanding of nanophysics that, you know, makes the trillion transistors on the head of a pin and so on and so forth, the laser scanners in grocery stores, your DVD players, everything that we now have in technology depends on some understanding of this micro, this nanophysics, and that's all quantum physics. And the other example I give is that Einstein's general theory of relativity, this theory that the shape of space and the passage of time are warped by the presence of mass and energy, you might think, well, that might even be true, but who cares? Well, you know what? GPS, the global positioning system, wouldn't work if the physicists and engineers who conceived of and designed GPS hadn't taken into account Einstein's general relativity, because the clocks in the satellites up there, which communicate with the clocks in your gizmo in your car, are running at different rates because of general relativity. So GPS, with all its military and commercial applications, would not exist if it were not for physicists' understanding of the general theory of relativity. So there you go.
There we go. Alex, thank you so very much for a fabulous talk. Add that to your 1,000 that you've already given. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patty. Thank you, students.
Thank you also to Lily and Sarah and Stephanie for being with us today. And if you would like to tune in again to Radio Physics, it's the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30 on KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado. If you'd like to know more about our program of gophers here at the Physics Center, give me a call or look at our website at aspenphys.org. Thank you all for coming today.